Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This evening, the Secretary of State of Florida has decided to certify what, by any reasonable standard, is an incomplete and inaccurate count of the votes cast in the state of Florida.
Joe Lieberman, circa 2000. Remember when he was a Democrat? 30 issues in 30 days. Issue number one, will your vote count? What has changed 8 years after that Bush versus Gore debacle in Florida and Washington? This kicks off our presidential election series, 30 issues in 30 days. We will have an issue a day at this time for our next 30 shows. Let others talk about lipstick. We also thank you for nominating issues and voting on your top three over the last few weeks. By far, the top vote getter, in case you're interested, was alternative and renewable energy and our carbon footprint, followed by health care and civil liberties. So we will, of course, tackle all three topics among the 30. Parts 1 through 5, all this week, focus on the state of our democracy. Because if we're going to have an election, we might as well take stock of the context of that election. What is the state of our democracy? Beginning right now with issue number 1, will your vote be counted? What has changed 8 years after Bush versus Gore? You know, it hasn't been much in the headlines, but skirmishes are already breaking out in various swing states over alleged attempt at voter suppression. And today is the first day to vote in what might be the ultimate swing state, Virginia, this year. Can you believe it? Early voting starts today in Virginia, Kentucky, Georgia, and a few others. And so the vote is actually on as of right now. Now, Virginia Tech sent out letters warning students they could not vote in Virginia if their parents live elsewhere, which is not true. They took it back. But the effect apparently lingers. Here is a student at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia, on NPR last week.
A lot of students are confused because they've heard around campus that you cannot use your address to register to vote. If they hear that, they're going to say, well, I'm not going home, so I guess I'm skipping out.
Now, in Michigan, a serious battleground this year, there's dust up over a possible move to crack down on people whose homes have recently been foreclosed on because their address would obviously change. In Florida, good old Florida, there's a dust-up over mailings to registered Democrats telling them they are registered as Republicans. Florida Democrat Marilyn DeMauro of Naples on NPR on Friday.
And I thought, well, that's strange because I'm a Democrat. And when I opened the envelope, it was a card that said that I was listed as a Republican with my registration number. So I immediately got my Democratic card, and the registration number was not the same.
Now, in partisan terms, Democrats tend to be more concerned about voter suppression, Republicans about voter fraud. We will talk about both, beginning with Tova Wang, Vice President for Research at the good government group Common Cause. Common Cause, along with the Century Foundation, have a new report called Voting in 2008, 10 Swing States, and Tova is the lead author. We have a link to that report on our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show if you want to see it. As we kick off 30 issues in 30 days, issue one, will your vote be counted? Tova Wang, thanks for coming on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Your report goes state by state and topic by topic. Your
right.
Topics include voting machine problems, voter registration and ID, deceptive practices, student voting rights, and others. So let's just focus on those issues that I raised in the intro and a few of the most hotly contested states this year, Virginia, Michigan, Ohio, Colorado. I mentioned the student voting issue
right.
In Virginia. Virginia Tech apologized and rescinded the warning. Has that been resolved as far as you're concerned?
Not in a satisfactory manner. You know, first of all, Virginia has a history of this. Virginia has, in other elections, made it quite difficult for student voters to vote from their campus address as they have the right to do. And in addition, the Secretary of State there has for a long time had on the website of the Secretary of State documents related to student voting that implied that a student would be jeopardizing their scholarship or their tax status or other things or their tuition, their scholarships, if they registered to vote from campus, which is all completely misleading and deceptive.
Was it an innocent mistake? Was it a dirty trick?
You know, it's hard to know. I'm troubled because this is not the first time this has come up in Virginia. Virginia has, as I said, had lawsuits in the past over student voting rights, and they've backpedaled a little bit on what they've been doing, but not entirely. I believe if you go to the website now, and I haven't in the last few days, but many of those questions that students are supposed to ask themselves before they register to vote in Virginia are still up there. And there's obviously now, you know, tremendous confusion, which, you know, it's just, you have to start to be skeptical at sometimes whether this is all coincidence or a mistake.
And I guess if somebody's trying to suppress student votes, that would be somebody who doesn't want Obama to win because he's so popular with the campus crowd.
Well, there is a legitimate concern that I have, at least, throughout the country, not just Virginia, that you're seeing incredible increases in voter registration and turnout among young people during the primaries. And even before that, this is actually the third election cycle in which we've seen a great increase in student participation, young participation. But unfortunately, it seems like in this country, sometimes when people start participating, there's a backlash. And so I'm concerned that students, in addition to other kinds of new voters this year, will have sort of targets on their backs now that all of a sudden, my God, young people are actually participating. And they will be singled out for this type of activity and other kinds of challenges to their voting rights. So that's something certainly in all these states that we're taking a look at.
Why else do you call Virginia one of the most problematic states this year?
Well, I'm most concerned about Virginia for a number of reasons. I mean, in general, there are two areas of concern that I have. One is that there's going to be this unprecedented turnout. We have an election system in this country in general that is exquisitely positioned and structured for low rates of participation, because that's what we've had for the last many years. Now, all of a sudden, you're seeing people incredibly engaged and turnout rates being predicted at 80% and even higher. And we don't have a structure or a system in place or the laws in place that necessarily are designed to handle that kind of participation. Virginia, in particular, has been seeing incredible increases in registration, and there's huge expected turnout there. Virginia also has not been a swing state in the past, so they're not entirely used to the microscope and haven't necessarily had to re-examine how they're doing things or what their laws are on the books that they might otherwise have needed to if they were a swing state in the past. So they're going to have the microscope on them in a way they haven't before. So the one area of concern is dealing with the turnout, and then the second area is what we've been talking about, and that is, given the huge turnout, given the expected closeness of the election, and the temperature of the electorate this year, I'm also concerned about tactics being used by different individuals and groups to try and deter certain voters from voting. And there are not, in Virginia and there are not in several other places, sufficient laws on the books to ensure that people have an easy time voting, are not challenged if they're eligible, legitimate voters, and that's what I'm troubled by.
Virginia does, I understand, have election day voter registration, same day registration. Is that correct?
Not that I'm aware of, actually.
Okay, I thought I had read that, but maybe I got that wrong.
No, I just think that's not right. And there are only about 9 states in the country that do have election day registration, which is something that we support very strongly. It's actually the one sort of structural tweak in the system that you can make that there is just amazing amounts of evidence has an impact on voter turnout, particularly among young people, as a matter of fact.
And what do you think about this early voting? I'm going to read from a USA Today article this morning. Voters by the thousands will begin casting ballots for president this week in an early voting process that's expected to set records this year. Residents of Virginia, Kentucky, and Georgia are among the first in the nation eligible to vote in person as well as by mail, and that actually does start today. During the next few weeks, at least 34 states and Washington, D.C. will allow early in-person voting for the November 4th elections. And this article estimates that early voting could be up this year from 15% in 2000, 20% in 2004 in closely contested Colorado, another of the most the swinginest of swing states this year. About half the voters are expected to cast ballots before Election Day. and another 40% in Florida. Is this a good thing, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's sort of a double-edged sword. I know that election administrators are hoping that this level of early voting will mean that they won't have the problem of long lines at the polls. I'm a little skeptical, first of all, because I don't think, and we talk about this at length in the report, that the states or the localities have really serious plans in place for how they're going to allocate voting machines and allocate poll workers and that kind of thing. But the studies on this have also shown that it's people who are really hardcore partisans and already are 100% certain of their vote that engage in this kind of voting. And so I'm not sure that they're going to alleviate the problems at the polls as much as they think. And I think that early voting has gotten a little excessive. We're, 6 weeks out from the election, and people are already making decisions when so many other things can come up between now and the election.
Really? On the other hand, one of the big problems with our electoral system, I think, is that voting is so constrained to one day. They do it over a weekend in some countries. They do
I totally agree
They do
with
it
that.
On the weekend in some countries. You know, there's a whole movement out there. There's a group called Why Tuesday.
I'm on their board. I'm a big supporter
you
of
are.
Why Tuesday.
So, I mean, you know, you certainly could argue that, yeah, while the most partisan people may be the first to rush out and vote on, you know, September 22nd when that becomes available as it is today in some places, also a lot of other people who may not actually be able to get away from their jobs or whatever, or going to be away from home on Tuesday, November 4th, can take an opportunity. It should increase turnout, at least theoretically.
Well, Brian, I couldn't agree with you more. I am a supporter of particularly in-person early voting, being able to vote on weekends. I think 6 weeks is excessive. I think, you know, a week or two before the election is sufficient to address the concerns about people not being able to get to the polls. I think a more effective answer to that would probably be to take steps to make sure that on election day or during the 1 or 2 week early voting period, there are enough voting machines and there are enough poll workers in place to make sure that the voting process is not one where people anticipate having a half day, having to give up half a day of their work or tending to their kids, but actually are able to vote in a few minutes like some people in some luckier communities are able to do.
We have a few minutes for phone calls for Tova Wang from Common Cause, author of a new report that Common Cause has put out with the Century Foundation called tell me the exact title again. Sorry.
It's voting in 2008, 10 swing states. So we look at 10 critical states this year and where they are with the election process and whether they're ready for the turnout and ready to make sure that people's voting rights are respected.
All right. One of the swing states. Oh, and our number, 212-433-WNYC. Of course, we're collecting comments and questions on our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. But call us up, 212-433-9692. Good news from your report. Ohio, obviously a huge swing state, obviously the epicenter of voter problems in 2004, long lines, voting machines that switched votes, alleged suppression of voter registration by the Ohio Secretary of State, and more. But you see Ohio as much improved, don't you?
I do. That's really the good news out of the report, is Ohio has improved a lot, in part because of some new laws and also in an even greater part by some steps that the Secretary of State there, the new Secretary of State, has taken in the last few years. One of the biggest problems we saw in 2004, and you already alluded to something that indicates that it's going to happen again this time, is the issue of vote caging and challenging people's right to vote at the polls. And vote caging is essentially where a group or a party or an individual will send out a mailing to a particular community. And if any of the mail comes back as undeliverable, those people, they'll be put on a list. And that list will be used to challenge their eligibility to be on the registration list or actually be used as a list at the polls on election day to challenge people's right to vote. 35,000 people had their voter registration challenged in Ohio in 2004. It was hugely controversial. There were several pieces of litigation surrounding it. The legislature did step in, made it more difficult to engage in that kind of activity in an abusive way. And in fact, the Secretary of State just in the last month issued a directive basically saying that somebody could not automatically be taken off the registration list due to a single piece of undeliverable mail, which is a real step in a positive direction. And they also addressed their voting machine allocation issue, not through the law, but you'll remember in 2004, we remember the images of students at Kenyon College in particular who were waiting until 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning in order to vote because there were only two machines on the campus, where other people in the state were, taking 5 minutes to to vote. The legislature didn't do anything about that, but Secretary of State, again, in a real show of leadership, issued a directive to all the counties there to use a particular formula that would essentially mean 175 voters per voting machine, which is a very good standard. And because she doesn't have complete control over the counties, she asked them that if they were not going to follow this formula, that they in advance publicize what plan they intended to use and why they weren't using this formula. So we will know in Ohio just how these local elections officials will be allocating voting machines, and everyone can see whether they think it's going to be fair or not, because there were all sorts of controversies in 2004 about some communities feeling as though intentionally they had been given fewer machines than other communities to suppress the vote, and hopefully that will be avoided this year.
Here is Susan on Staten Island, a poll worker who has a concern about early voting. Hi, Susan. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. How are you today?
Okay.
Good. I like the idea of voting more than one day. It'd be nice with mail-in, but from what you already said, I assume you're talking about having sites open. We have a shortage of workers now. How do you have any particular practical plan for recruiting more poll workers with this idea of opening the polls for more than one day?
All right, it's a nuts and bolts question.
Yeah, well, the states that do it, it's not like they have all the polling places that you see open on November 4th open during the early voting period. It's much, much fewer places. And actually, one of the arguments that's made that's not without merit is that, if you have these fewer sites, you actually get the best of the poll workers during that period. So it's not the kind of undertaking that you see on election day itself, so that sort of mitigates that problem.
Jim in Morristown has another concern about early voting. Hi, Jim.
Hello. My concern is that despite its conveniences, early voting means that the campaign organizations have to be at a greater pitch over a longer period of time to get in their votes. If you have one day to concentrate on, the campaigns can concentrate on that day, but if you have a week, the campaign with the more money, it systematically favors campaigns with more money.
Oh, that's interesting. When they go to that end game of getting out the vote.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. Actually, there's no question that this does nothing for one of our other issues here at Common Cause, which is campaign finance reform. It certainly increases the cost of campaigns, and now it's exactly as the caller said. They used to have 48-hour plans, get-out-the-vote plans, the campaigns. Now they're calling them the 720-hour campaigns, get-out-the-vote plans.
Yeah.
There's no question that this changes the dynamics of the campaigns as well.
Allie in Virginia wants to correct my mistake about same-day voter registration in Allie's state. Hi, Allie.
Hi.
Where in Virginia are you?
I'm in Charlottesville.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, that deadline for registration here is actually October 6th, and I've been volunteering with the Obama campaign, getting people registered, especially in the low-income neighborhoods, and a lot of them have registered like a month ago, and they still haven't gotten their cards. And I'm a little concerned that the registration office is not going to be able to process this like boom in registration.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big worry of ours, especially. And you guys were talking about the returned mail thing. I wonder if that's happening in Virginia too, because
you're in Charlottesville, so you're by UVA, right?
Yeah. And, a few weeks or just earlier last week, Michelle Obama came to UVA and had a rally with the students about voter registration. And the Obama campaign was trying to get out-of-state students to register in Virginia because of its swing state status.
Allie, thank you very much. Now, David in Manhattan doesn't like that idea, I don't think, of students voting where they go to school rather than where they live. Is that right, David?
That's correct. I teach at university, and in smaller communities, this is a real problem because the interests of students who are under 22 and from out of the area are very different than the townsfolk. The townsfolk really don't care who the students vote for president, but they care very much about the mayor, the assembly, or the state senate. And ultimately, students can step forward and say, well, this is going to be like a student election. In some towns, the students outnumber the locals, sometimes by 5-1.
Mm.
In a case like that, they're really skewing the election. And it's not about letting some 21-year-old get a political future by being the youngest person ever elected mayor of a small town.
Tova Wang, what about that? Fair concern, huh?
Yes and no. I understand his concern, but I think it's a little unfair to the students. This is where they live for 9 or 10 months out of the year, if not the full year round. They are quite engaged in the community often. And let's face it, this is a hugely transient country. I mean, students may move after 4 years, but a lot of people move every 2 years in this country, probably greater than the student population. So it's a little unfair to single students out as being as not having the right to participate on an equal level with the rest of the community. And it's simply, you know, not the law of the land. I mean, there are different rules in different states, and we go through some of that. And the Brennan Center actually has a terrific guide to student voting rights all over the country.
It's also an issue, though, of the rights of the permanent population of a place, relatively permanent, and the rights of the transient population coming through to go to school there and probably leave. No?
You can set it up that way, but I don't think it necessarily needs to be looked at that way. I think, as I said, a lot of these students are quite committed to the communities that they live in and go to school at, and some of them will stay.
All right. We're over time. We have Miles Rappaport and John Fund standing by to talk about voter fraud and some other things. Let me just get a couple of real quick takes from you. Number one, we played the clip of the Democratic woman in Florida who got the mailing telling her she's registered as a Republican,
right,
and with a made-up voter registration number, apparently. Have you looked into how widespread that is, and why would it matter? She knows she's a Democrat.
Well, what it indicates to me is that, once again, we're going to see this year what we call deceptive practices. You know, we saw in 2004 much worse incidents than this. So this is probably just the beginning. But, you know, things like flyers being circulated saying, you know, if you have unpaid parking tickets, you're not allowed to vote. And if you show up, you'll be arrested. Because of the huge increase in registration and an expected turnout, Republicans vote on Tuesday and Democrats on Wednesday. And one of the things that we looked at in this report is that, in fact, the federal voting rights law doesn't address this kind of activity. This is not explicitly illegal activity under federal law. So it's up to states to have laws that directly criminalize and take measures to ensure that voters get the right information with laws on their books. And very, very, very few states have such laws.
So in general, do you think we're in much better shape than at the time of Bush versus Gore? Much worse shape or something in between?
It's so hard to predict. I mean, no one, you know, everyone thought the big problem coming out of Florida 2000 was the voting machines and the hanging chads. And so we got rid of all the voting machines, and now everyone's concerned about the reliability of the electronic voting machines that were supposed to be the answer to that. So it's sort of like, you know, you often, it seems like you solve one problem and another is created. There are a lot of new issues up this year, and so we'll have to see if between now and the election that elections officials working with groups like ours and working with voters can try and address some of them before Election Day.
Is there any one state that you are watching the most closely for a possible recount meltdown that'll keep us going till December 10th?
God, I hope not. You know, it could happen in any of these close states. Again, it comes back to how close the election itself is. If it's really, really, really close, then you could see it in any one of these swing states that we studied, including Florida again. Florida got a very bad rating from us again, unfortunately, you know, states like Georgia and Virginia. So it's not impossible, but for my own sake and the sake of the mental health of the country, I hope that doesn't happen.
Voting in 2008, 10 swing states, the new report from Common Cause and the Century Foundation. Tova Wang is the author. We've linked to it on our page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Larichelle. Thank you very much for starting us off on this.
Thank you.
And we continue as we turn the page to voter fraud, more of a concern of Republicans than Democrats in general. John Fund from The Wall Street Journal has written a whole book on it. The Supreme Court just came down with a major ruling to crack down on voter fraud that some people will result in voter suppression. So we will check that out when we continue. 30 issues in 30 days. Issue 1, will your vote be counted? Will the vote be free and fair? Stay with us.
But tonight, after a count, a recount, and yet another manual recount, Secretary Cheney and I are honored and humbled to have won the state of Florida, which gives us the needed electoral votes to win the election.
You remember that? If you were around in 2000, 30 issues in 30 days, issue number one. Will your vote be counted? What has changed 8 years after Bush versus Gore? And by the way, as part of our 30 issues in 30 days presidential election series, we have a 30 issues wiki. It's not just a comments page. It's a way for you to actually collaborate with each other to help produce six of our 30 programs. Check out the 30 issues wiki at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Well, the classic partisan split, as I said before, on voter systems is that Democrats worry about voter suppression and Republicans worry about voter fraud. For example, the Supreme Court this year upheld an Indiana law requiring more solid identification of voters as they arrive at the polls to prevent fraudulent overvoting. But Democrats tended to be more concerned that it would keep legitimate votes from counting. Yet the Supreme Court said voter fraud is a legitimate concern, and even if there's no immediate current evidence, steps to prevent voter fraud are constitutionally legitimate. So we will get two views on how our election system stacks up on this measure and more now with John Fund, Wall Street Journal editorial board member and columnist, author of the 2004 book Stealing Elections, How Voter Fraud Threatens Our Democracy, and Miles Rappaport, a former Connecticut Secretary of State and president of the liberal think tank known as Demos. So welcome back, Miles. Welcome back, John. Thanks for coming on WNYC today.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
John Fund, let me start with the Indiana Supreme Court ruling from earlier this year. What does it actually say, and what will it mean, in your opinion?
Well, I think that it simply gives more deference to the states as they design voter identification laws. The majority of states still, to this day, do not require the showing of significant identification before one votes. So this affects Indiana. It affects a few other states that have gone this route. But in the vast majority of cases in this country, we are on the honor system. If you want to show up at the polls and claim you are someone, you scrawl a signature. There's no one who's trained in signature verification. Effectively, you could vote. Does it happen often? No. I think that some voter ID laws have to be combined with laws against absentee ballot fraud, which is also a very significant problem. But John Paul Stevens, who's one of the most liberal members of the Supreme Court, had an extensive history of dealing with voter fraud in Chicago, and he was very clear that this is a legitimate exercise of the state's power to try to improve confidence in the legitimacy of elections, because 40% of people today, Brian, 40% either believe there is massive voter suppression or massive voter fraud. And as a result, that may be one of the reasons we have a lower voter turnout and less confidence in our elections. I think we have to improve our systems so that more people believe that there aren't barriers to people voting and more people believe there aren't people committing fraudulent votes.
We went through with Tova Wang from Common Cause a whole long list of individual incidents breaking out around the country now that at least raise suspicions of voter suppression. Is there anything equivalent with respect to voter fraud that you're keeping your eye on?
Well, you know, I think Common Cause does good work, but I find it interesting that all of their work is in the area of voter suppression. In my book, I have an extensive section on Republican voter fraud and mentioned vote suppression. The section is called Republican Strong Arm Tactics. I try to address both. I have here a large file of material from the liberal group Acorn, and they are involved in voter registration fraud. Their employees in state after state, whether it's Pennsylvania, whether it's Michigan, Wisconsin, Louisiana. And this raises lots of concerns because the Barack Obama campaign paid $800,000 to an offshoot of Acorn and misrepresented that in their federal election reports. I am concerned that both campaigns often let people working for them go off the rails and go in to do things that they shouldn't do. And in this case, I'm very concerned that Barack Obama, who used to be an attorney for Acorn, has retained an Acorn offshoot for campaign services when Acorn has such a checkered record. How checkered a record? Acorn's founder, Wade Rathke, allowed his brother to be the chief financial officer for Acorn for many years. His brother embezzled $1 million. Rathke, when he discovered that his brother had done this, he never alerted the authorities. He never alerted his own board. And it was only uncovered in the New York Times over the summer. And only then did Rathke's brother leave. This is a very troubled organization. And this is an organization that is spending $40 million registering voters. And I think it's very problematic.
And I'll read from an article that you wrote, a column in the Wall Street Journal. You say Acorn's efforts to register voters have been scandal-prone in St. Louis. They found that over in 2006, over 1,000 addresses listed on its registrations didn't exist. In Seattle, local officials invalidated 1,762 Acorn registrants. Felony charges were filed against seven of its workers, some of whom have criminal records. Miles Rappaport from Demos, have you looked into the Acorn question specifically to address that and also on the larger issue of voter fraud?
Well, let me start with the larger issue if I can and come back to the Acorn question. I mean, I think one of the things that we all ought to be really pleased about is that clearly this election, the 2008 election, is generating interest and excitement and voter registration and voter turnout, you know, in an unprecedented way, both in the primaries and presumably in the general. I think, as a former Secretary of the State, this is to be applauded and to be you know, maintained and encouraged. So on the issue of voter fraud, I think that there ought to be significant enforcement. The state election enforcement commissions or the attorneys general ought to have the resources to go after it where it exists. The mistake, I believe, that the Indiana legislature made is that to do sort of a blanket, you know, tightening up of the voter process, which I think will, in fact, discourage large numbers of legitimate voters from voting. And I think that is a tragic thing. I think we ought to make it possible and accessible, not harder, for people to vote. And on the fraud issue, I really think that this is a case where the cure is far worse than the disease. I don't quarrel with John's statement that there are some examples of voter fraud. The federal government, the Justice Department, had an initiative called the Ballot Access and Voting Integrity Initiative. Between October 2002 and September of 2005, so 3 years, and there were a total of 70 convictions under that program. That's the federal government, Justice Department, Bush administration. It just is very, very rare, very small, and I think the idea of clamping down on registration procedures and on voting procedures with very tight ID requirements is a huge error. In terms of Acorn, you know, I think that what I understand of it, and I've never been involved with the organization, clearly they have registered large, large numbers of people. In the course of that, some errors were made. Some employees probably did, you know, in the interest of puffing up their numbers, do that. But in every case that I'm aware of, Acorn cooperated very closely with the investigations and the prosecutions of those people, and as an organization, tried to make sure that they were not doing it. So I think, besides, I guess I have to say, with in terms of John, I thought that the issues we were discussing here were going to be the policy issues about how voting ought to be regulated. This is appearing to be a partisan attack on Acorn, and I'm sorry that John decided that that was what he wanted to talk about.
Well, I was asked for specific examples,
I did ask him the question. Now, but let's talk about policy. And let me ask you both whether you think that John McCain and Barack Obama are different on any of the major questions of how elections should be regulated to maximize democracy and, you know, in all the aspects of that. John Fund, I'll go to you first. Is this an issue between the two candidates?
Well, we do have a conflict of visions here. I think that there is a school of thought out there which believes that voting is so important that we don't need a lot of restrictions or safeguards against it, and that, as Mr. Rappaport says, the cure can be worse than the disease. There are other people who very much are concerned with the rule of law, and they believe that even though we have a checkered history in our past in the 1960s and 1970s of people being denied the right to vote, we've made significant progress. We need to make sure that there is no voter intimidation suppression that needs to be prosecuted vigorously, but that voter fraud, which we thought was asleep and had gone away, is back more and more. And my book is replete with examples, including a 77-page police investigation of Milwaukee in the 2004 and 2006 elections, which is replete with examples of how outside groups entered entered the city, and many of their campaign workers who were only there temporarily ended up voting. There was massive abuse of the same-day registration system. This is an official police report, and it's 76 pages. Milwaukee was a very close state in 2004. I suspect it will be again. St. Louis, other cities, all of them have these problems. That's why we have to address two civil rights here. There are two civil rights: the civil right to make sure no one is prevented or intimidated or blocked from voting, and the civil right of all of your listeners not to have their vote canceled out by someone who shouldn't be voting, is voting twice, or doesn't even exist. And that does happen.
I'm sure you agree on those two principles, Miles. How does it translate to different kind of voter regulation policies, which obviously is what you want to talk about?
Yeah, no, I do agree that there are two sides of this coin. But I think that the characterization on the voter fraud side of the coin, on fraudulent voting by people registering twice or voting at multiple precincts, is really, really minimal. There was testimony at my Laura Meniddia, professor at Barnard, who happens to be, and I'm proud that she is, a Demos fellow, that went through all of the cases over the last several years and found that when you actually break them down, the number of actual people who deliberately set out to violate the voter law is teeny out of hundreds of millions of people who cast votes during that time. So I just think that this is an issue that's being blown way out of proportion. I do think that reasonable voter identification laws that allow people the opportunity to without excessive hardship to identify themselves are reasonable. And I think that the laws that really make that criminalize deceptive practices, voter intimidation, are also very reasonable to do. I'm very hopeful that the biggest issue, and I think Tova Wang pointed it out, that we're likely to face this year is just that the voting districts are and voting administrations will be overwhelmed by the sheer number of people voting. So I'm hopeful that all those voting administrations, whether they be secretaries of the state or municipal administrations, get ready for the number of people so that they don't have, you know, the long lines and the argumentation over mm-hmm. the validity of their roles. But I also think that going back to your original question, both Barack Obama and John McCain have had reasonably good records on these election issues. Barack Obama was the sponsor of the Deceptive Practices Act as a senator and also co-sponsored Hillary Clinton's Count Every Vote Act. John McCain, of course, has the McCain-Feingold bill on campaign finance named after him. And so I think that, I'm hopeful that both of these gentlemen really believe in democracy and will make sure that it is expanded as much as we possibly can. I think that would be healthy for our society. We can prevent the small amount of voter fraud with enforcement, but we don't need blanket voter identification laws that make it harder for people to vote.
John, does it matter to you if in practice rather than in theory it winds up in Indiana discouraging more people from voting than fraudulent votes that it stops? And do you think that's a realistic possibility?
Well, the most recent election in which this was handled was the mayoral election in Indianapolis, November 2007. A total of about 34 people were turned away because they lacked sufficient identification. They had the right to go to a local election office, show their identification, and vote within 10 days. Of those 34, I believe only 3 chose to do so. 34 voters out of 135,000 is a small number. We don't know if the 31 voters who chose not to show up were valid or invalid voters. We just know they were turned away. Some of those may have been invalid voters. Many of them may have been valid. I think that is a small price to pay for the election security that's offered. And by the way, Miles, I agree with you that in-person impersonation of a voter is not particularly common. But absentee ballot fraud is a serious problem. I don't think the voter IDs laws address that.
How do you prevent?
I think we have to go further.
How do you
prevent
that?
We have to address absentee ballot fraud.
How do you prevent that?
Larry Sabato says it's a disaster waiting to happen.
How do you prevent that?
He's one of the most distinguished. Well, I think there's several ways. One thing, I think we are reaching a point now where half the country is going to be voting absentee in a few elections and half the country isn't. That's too much. We have people voting today before any of the presidential debates. I think they're voting with a different information set than people a month from now. I think you can reduce the number of absentee ballots down to number of people who actually need them, like the sick, the indigent, and the people who definitely know they're traveling. And I also believe that you can, in theory, Very easily have people apply a thumbprint to their absentee ballot or have a method of digitally scanning into voter ID if they have a computer. There are certainly ways that can increase the ballot security for absentee voters.
Miles, good idea?
No, I don't think so, and I don't think it's necessary. In the states of Oregon and Washington, where they have gone to a mail-in ballot, they don't call it absentee ballots, they call it mail-in ballots, they've had higher turnout and extremely low incidences of fraud, virtually non-existent. The Secretary of the State in Washington is a Republican. The Secretary of the State in Oregon is a Democrat. They both say that their voting by mail systems have been successful. I think that the thing that Secretaries of the State have bemoaned for so long is that the voter turnout in the United States has been extremely low. And I think what we ought to be doing is make sure that every voter who is a legitimate voter has the opportunity to do it, whether that's voting by mail or early voting in person. I also believe strongly that people ought to be able to register and vote on election day. I think that would be a huge advantage to people with reasonable identification, absolutely. So I think we ought to just encourage all this. I find it puzzling that because of the possibilities of fraud, which even the Supreme Court said, the fact that they don't exist doesn't mean that they won't exist, are so minimal that the clamping down on people and giving them fewer options to vote, it almost makes you suspect that the real motivation here is that people don't want certain people to vote. And I don't think that's that. I think that's a shame if it's true.
We're over time, but let me get just a very quick take, like 20 seconds each. Voter ID aside, on this question of early voting, Virginia, which might be the ultimate swing state that keeps us up till 6 o'clock in the morning on election night or maybe till December 10th, who knows, Virginia, people can vote starting today, as John said, before even any of the presidential debates are held. Miles Rapport, is that a good idea?
It's the longest period in the country, it may be longer than we need. But overall, I think that early voting can do is make sure that people who are busy on election day, may have to work overtime, may not be able to get time off from their employer, can have the opportunity to vote early. So I think it's a good policy.
John Fund, 20 seconds.
The Washington State governor's race melted down in 2004. There were more votes cast by felons, the dead, and illegal voters than worth the margin of difference. The Secretary of State in Washington State just had to remove 500,000 names from their mailing list that were invalid voters. 500,000 names. There is a problem, and it melted down in Washington State and proved that that problem can swing an election.
Stealing Elections, How Voter Fraud Threatens Our Democracy is the book by John Fund, the Wall Street Journal editorial board member and columnist. Miles Rapoport is the former Secretary of State of Connecticut, these days president of the think tank Demos. Thank you both very much for doing this.
Great. Thanks, Brian. We're at Demos.org.
Demos.org and WSJ.com, right? Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. And we continue in a minute by looking specifically at the voter systems in New York and New Jersey. Will your votes be counted? Stay tuned.
Just a piece of paper. A vote is a human voice, a statement of human principle, and we must not let those voices be silenced.
Al Gore, who for a short time thought he was the next president of the United States, that clip from 2000. By the way, this Friday night at 8, I'll be hosting a pre-debate special called Public Radio's Election Reset. We'll be live here on WNYC and around the country on public radio stations and XM satellite radio. That's Friday night at 8 o'clock, just before the first Obama-McCain debate, which we will carry live at 9. Well, this is 30 Issues in 30 Days. Issue number one, as we premiere the series today, will your vote be counted? What has changed 8 years after Bush versus Gore? And let's go local for our last few minutes and look at New York's and New Jersey's voting systems now. With me are Penny Vanitas, professor at the Rutgers Law School, co-director of the Constitutional Litigation Clinic there, and Douglas Kellner, co-chair of the New York State Board of Elections and a partner in the law firm of Kellner, Herlihy, Getty, and Friedman. Did I get all the partners, Doug?
You did. Thank you, Brian. It's great to talk to you again.
And Penny Vanitas, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot.
And Penny, you think New Jersey has issues, don't you?
New Jersey has many issues, and Doug has been an advisor and a consultant through the years on some of the issues that have come up in New Jersey. Our most fundamental problem in New Jersey is that the voting computers that New Jersey citizens have been voting on are fundamentally flawed. We really do not know whether they count votes. They are voting computers that have been analyzed thoroughly by other states. Indeed, California and Ohio certified some of the computers that are used here. My experts who work at Princeton, who are computer scientists, computer security professors there, recently did a very thorough examination of the majority of the voting computers used in New Jersey. Unfortunately, under court order, we're not permitted to release our results until October 2nd, but the computers that were recently examined share many of the features, the flawed features of the voting computers that have been examined and rejected by California and Ohio.
So there's no paper trail.
There is no paper trail. There was supposed to be a paper trail. That was a very long and hard-fought battle that we won. There was supposed to be a paper trail in place over a year ago, and it hasn't come to fruition. And as a result, New Jersey voters are in a very, very precarious situation because they do not know whether their votes are going to be counted.
So what would actually happen on election night and beyond if there's any question?
Well, your guess is as good as mine. You know, there have been reported breakdowns of these voting computers. What's happened when there have been problems in the past with these voting computers is that certain votes determine the elections, the outcomes of the elections, and those are votes that are cast on paper, surprise, surprise, in the form of absentee votes or emergency ballots. Because basically, in the best-case scenario, if you ask a voting computer to give you a recount, you press a button and you really hope that it gives you the same number, which actually hasn't always happened. What ends up happening is because at some point you really can't trust the results of the voting computer, you really go to the paper and you examine the absentee ballots and the emergency ballots, and then those actually determine the outcome of close elections or elections where there's been a problem.
So, Doug Kellner, as head of the Board of Elections in New York State, are you the one shopping around for what kind of technology is going to replace our old pull-the-lever clunkers?
Well, New York has actually avoided the kinds of problems that Penny has described by taking a go-slow, careful attitude and saying we're not going to put in the new electronic equipment until it's been fully tested. And what we've discovered in the process is that none of the equipment that anybody is using anywhere in the country meets all of the standards that have been established by the United States Election Assistance Commission. So New York is going to continue using its lever machines this year. We hope that this will be the last year, but nobody's promising that that's the case. In the end, we're confident that we will avoid a lot of the problems that other states have seen.
And it's funny because these old mechanical machines used to seem outdated. Now, with all this fear about electronic unverified voting, they seem like old reliables. Are they, in fact?
They are, because it's extremely difficult to commit fraud on them. Not impossible, but the kinds of fraud that can be committed on lever machines are done on a retail basis, because you have to do it machine by machine. As soon as you get into electronic machines, you can commit fraud on a wholesale basis by changing the programming of the machines. So people have come to appreciate that the lever machines are a fairly reliable form of technology. The reason we're replacing them is not because of their reliability, but because visually impaired voters are unable to use a lever machine, and Congress has made it clear that any voting device has to be fully accessible to persons with disabilities.
So, Penny Vanitas, what's the ultimate policy issue here for New Jersey? Are they going to have to decide to allocate the money to replace all these new voting machines with newer voting machines?
Well, Brian, you really raise a very, very interesting point, an important point. What's happened is that the thinking since the Help America Vote Act was passed after the Florida Florida debacle in 2000. Everybody rushed to use the billions of dollars that were made available by Congress to buy computer technology, thinking that that was the solution. Well, time has shown that this first wave of voting computers that were purchased, the direct recording electronic touchscreen computers that were bought, were actually incredibly vulnerable. So now there's the second wave where everybody who has studied the issue has found that actually optical scanners that scan paper ballots are a more reliable form of voting, because at the end of the day you have the voter's intent recorded on a piece of paper that can be examined.
So
now New Jersey has earmarked money to spend to upgrade the flawed machines, and what should really happen is New Jersey should follow what over 20 states have done and say, okay, this system that we have is flawed. We were too rash. We rushed out and bought these computer voting systems, and since we have to spend $40 million to upgrade them, we may as well just spend the same money and buy a voting system that is better.
I wish we had more time. We have 30 seconds. No early voting in New York, Doug, right?
Just the you have to be anticipating that you're going to be out of town or that you're going to be sick in order to vote by absentee ballot.
Same in New Jersey, Penny?
Well, actually, no. It has been the law for the past 4 years that anyone can vote by absentee ballot. So citizens of New Jersey can go onto the Secretary of State's website and follow instructions and get a form to get an absentee ballot and submit that.
Good to know. Penny Vanitas from the Rutgers Law School, co-director of the Constitution Litigation Clinic there. Douglas Kellner, co-chair of the New York State Board of Elections. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Brian.
And that's 30 Issues in 30 Days, issue number one, What Has Changed 8 Years After Bush versus Gore. Tomorrow, issue two, Obama's and McCain's Special Interest.